Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Is something missing in today's world? In this compelling episode of This Week in America, I talk with William Bruce Dredge, author of The Daycroft Factor, a memoir, a deeply reflective look at the moral, ethical, and spiritual values that shaped a life spanning journalism, Wall Street, and public service. Dredge takes us back to his formative years at a small private school in Connecticut, where a unique environment fostered leadership, integrity, and spiritual awareness, principles he carried through a remarkable career as a television journalist, financial professional, and community advocate. But this conversation goes beyond one man's story. It asks a much bigger question. Can the values that shaped past generations help repair what feels broken in society today? Insightful, honest, and thought-provoking, this conversation is for anyone who cares about the future and how we shape it. William Bruce Dredge has had a diverse professional background, journalism, investment, and public service. His memoir is The Daycroft Factor, and he joins us on This Week in America. William, a pleasure. Welcome to the program. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Rick. First, thanks very much for having me on your show. I look forward to it.
I'm really anxious to talk about what's in the book. The book is available wherever books are sold. I'll give you William's website as we go through the conversation today. What was the motivating factor? What made you go back and reflect on the Daycroft years and write The Daycroft Factor?
I guess if I were to encapsulate it in one word, it would be retirement. That's not the whole story. The Daycroft Factor was provided to me for 12 years at the Daycroft School, where I learned the value of the written word and where I developed an interest in writing. At Rutgers, I was an English major for the first three semesters until my brother-in-law got a hold of me and said, "You better get some business courses under your belt or you're going to starve to death." And I said, "Okay." So I did that. And then I embarked on a fairly unusual career path, which you have outlined earlier. And so when I retired in 2023, I had to go through a rather large home up in New Jersey in Princeton, where we had raised our three children. And when you do that, as you may know, you just accumulate so much stuff and it reminds you of the path that you've had. And, you know, this sacrilegious moth of time has a way of letting us sort of think back about the structural things and activity things in our life, which have sort of brought us to this point. And then we moved to coastal Delaware, and I found myself having some time, although, as you know, you move in for a period of about 3 years. And I started right. And out of the blue, I get a call from a dear friend, an old friend who sat on a board with me maybe 10, 15 years ago, a man named Hal Jordan, who is a writer in his own right. He, too, is an English major and a teacher of English during his professional career. And it got to the point where he started me to write. And then he introduced me to a person who is a publisher in his own right, has a blog called The Curmudgeon. And The Curmudgeon is a pretty high-end blog as blogs go. And I started doing some things for him, and then one thing led to another. And the publisher that it has published both The Daycroft Factor and another book have reached out to me, and I started bearing down on the writing of it. That combined with a desire, you know, as you hit a certain stage in life, you like to give back to the extent that you can. And as I looked around at the news environment, you know, I was with the Wall Street Journal for, I guess, 12 years. You look at the news environment, you say, things aren't going as well as they could be in our world. What can I do to initiate a repair of some kind? What contribution can I make? So that and a bunch of other things motivated my actually sitting down, bearing down and writing it. And then publishing is so fraught with all kinds of things that were brand new to me. You know, this new landscape, as I'm sure you are aware, with all different kinds of technological advances and every platform in the world that you can write on. I write for Substack, and I do some things for Curmudgeon and so forth. Tom Kermode is a pretty astute publisher in that new, that new medium. So I got a glimpse as to what's there, and frankly, I couldn't do it without my publisher, which is Primex, as you probably know. They do a great job keeping me on track.
Where did the idea come from to focus on the Daycroft factor? That obviously a very important part of your life, the years that shaped you, that you thought the messages that you were taught through 12 years would be valuable lessons for all of us today. How did that develop into this book?
So again, I spent a good 14 years in the news business on television. And as I looked around the newscape today, after I retired, I realized, I'd had a very myopic life for the most part in the investment business, very narrowly defined activity. I guess in 2012, I took training for about 6 months at night and in court for a position, or as a volunteer activity, as a court-appointed special advocate for children who have been removed from their homes due to substantiated abuse. And what that did, Rick, was to give me a look at the world that I never saw in the investment business. And I mean, never.
Yes.
I had clients with many millions of dollars with me complaining about the fact they couldn't get enough yield and they couldn't do
it. Yeah.
And I'm saying to myself, you think you have a problem? You want a problem? Go down to Trenton, New Jersey and talk to a 17-year-old who's sleeping on a sewer grate to stay warm at night in February. That's a problem.
Yes.
Now, how do you solve those problems? Well, CASA, going to court and being the sole voice for a child who is in foster care, that represents the sole voice that represents the interests of the child only, taught me an awful lot about what I could give back. And I did. Now, that's different than writing, although obviously you have to be able to communicate in writing. But visiting with people who, you can't imagine. So I was warned at one point, do not go there. And I said, why not? Because they shoot people. Oh, that. And then another time there was a gentleman who I had to speak with because he had guardianship before they had removed the kids from the home. And he said, "Oh, Mr. Dredge, when you get down here, you call me from your car. I don't want you walking on the streets."
Wow.
And I went, oh, that problem. So, but I did it anyway. And, truth be known, the problems are real for people and they need to be solved. Who's going to solve them? Government? Some collectivist, activity? No. One person at a time, solving one person for another person at a time, which is what, and because you're a volunteer, you get to do things that those who are dependent on the system can't do or are prohibited from doing. So I guess that idea that, hey, one person can make a difference, doesn't matter how old they are or how young they are for that matter, but you can make a difference if you have the Daycroft factor. In other words, and it has other names, obviously, but if you have a set of values that are deeply rooted in your consciousness and have been for years, you tend to recognize, why don't you try giving that back? Why don't you try doing something for others that is meaningful to them and that perhaps offers a repair? And by the way, that works. To this day, I get calls around the holidays and so forth. They call me Mr. Bill. Mr. Bill, how are you? And guys that young men that I was assigned to, and when they were 11 or 12 and stayed with them until they aged out of the system, still remember. And I know I made a difference. I kept them out of the gangs when I could. In fact, I don't think I've failed in that regard ever. Some of them have done reasonably well. And that is something that money cannot buy, you know, the
yes.
satisfaction of knowing that, you know, the best things in life are not things. You know, it's what you, you know, your wealth isn't really what you have. I'm grateful for what I have, but it's what you give that makes the world a better place.
And all of this reflects what you learned during those years in Daycroft. Talk about the values that they taught you that obviously made such an impact. They shaped all of your careers, the career in journalism, the career in finance, the pro bono work that you're doing, the lives that you saved. What were some of the values that really registered and stayed with you? Sometimes we learn things and we forget them. These messages at Daycroft stay with you.
Yeah. I think the length of time itself is telling, because my wife was a parochial school, St. Ladislaw's in New Brunswick, and then St. Peter's High School, and then before she went off to a secular college. But the Daycroft School was 12 years that was influenced by the morals and ethics of Christian Science, which Daycroft was not a church-related school per se. It had no official affiliation with the church, but the founder of the school in 1928 was a student of Christian Science, and she based the curriculum starting in the nursery school that she started, which became an elementary school, which became, you know, a junior high school, which became a prep school. She based it on the morals and the ethics of Christian Science. So I never knew anything else. In fact, in the summers, I went to a camp that was my parents had sacrificed mightily to send us both to the Daycroft School and a camp up in Hughesville, Pennsylvania. And I never knew anything else but those morals and ethics. It's a very strict, loving, but strict set of morals and ethics. The problem, as I outline in the book, was the perception, and I'll let readers of the book sort of fill it out, but there was some unawareness, perhaps, or inability to, on the part of the governance of the church, to change or challenge the view that the public had that, oh, the Christians, those people that don't believe in doctors who don't go to doctors, well, that's a real problem. It was a real problem. And I think to a degree, it still is, because that perception, although it has been forced to change perceptibly, is still around. And so when I look at that today, and I look at what the Daycroft School gave, and I appreciate the morals and the ethics of that influence, I also am grateful to know that the person who started the religion back in the 19th century knew that science itself would evolve. Don't forget, her peers were Pasteur and other scientists, yes, from, you know, the scientific age, and her approach was purely metaphysical. Christian Science as a doctrine or a religion teaches the ultimate unreality of matter, for example. Well, that's obviously the exact opposite of most of the materialism of this age. So what does the kid do? You know, well, they do pretty well. You know, you gain a lot from the morals and the ethics. The real issue becomes, what do you do as an adult? What do you do when you get into the world? I was 16 or so when I began, and I met a wonderful girl at the Daycroft School whose parents were not active in Christian Science. And man, did I begin to understand a lot about the fact that there's a whole new world out there. And of course, when I went off to Rutgers, you basically popped a cork for as long as you ordered. You were there, and, you know, I went through a bit of a wilderness experience, I suppose, as many young people do. but never lost sight of the morals and the ethics of that religion. So, and as I outline in the book, there was a lot during the course of this, what I'm told is an unusual career, that sort of made me look at these activities through the prism of what I had learned at the Daycroft School, and which I've, you know, euphemistically called the Daycroft Factor.
Yes.
Because it has, to this very day, and hopefully as long as the good Lord gives me, it'll be there, tried and true. And it manifests itself in so many different ways. I have a doctor's, I have two doctor's appointments tomorrow, as a matter of fact. So a long time ago, I decided, if I decide that I need to go to a doctor, I'm going to do that. The church isn't going to tell me what I can or cannot do. The state is not going to tell me what I cannot or cannot do with my body, except from perhaps, let's say, a vaccine that was not really mandatory. Of course, you can't get on an airplane or go to a restaurant or do anything else unless you get this shot. And why was signed this waiver? So took those two, you know, took those two things, took those two shots as well. I do, from a practical standpoint, what is humanly best under the circumstances. I will say that I tend to be a very, it's not a question of religion. I believe there is a power much bigger than all of us that each and every one of us can call on in times of need, in good times and bad. So I start there. But as I like to say to some people who are torn about the medical issue, you pray on the way to the hospital if needs be, you know, and I think that's where I came down on it. So the idea of the morals and the ethics transcend the problem that the church, frankly, has had in promulgating the morals and the ethics in a clear and consistent way to a wide audience.
Our guest is William Bruce Dredge. He's the author of The Daycroft Factor, a memoir, a book available wherever books are sold. William's website is wbdredgeco.com. That's on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. You can link on, click on, get information from Amazon on the book, another book that Bill has written, and we'll talk about, if time permits, later on during the course of the conversation. How did this foundation impact your career in journalism and financial services? Was this sort of the foundation? Did this sort of define the fundamentals of who you were as a journalist and as a financial advisor?
Well, that's a great question. Great insight, Rick. I would say that at the time I decided to go from my initial financial services activity to journalism, I was really struggling with who am I, what is it that I'm supposed to be doing, and what's the best way to do that. So in the process of that, I tripped over what became a major issue in litigation between the Boston-based Christian Science Church and a small church in Plainfield, New Jersey, which I write up in the book. And I met some folks there who I really, really resonated with. One fellow, a man named Gary Singletary, who was the Morgan Stanley investment banker at the time, very young guy who had settled over in Plainfield, which it didn't have the greatest reputations as towns go after the riots of 67. But he decided, you know what, this can be healed. You know, we can fix this. So those words exactly, but, you know, his view was it's a perfectly good place to live. And there were some other folks there who influenced me that, hey, you don't have to, if this work that you're doing now, particularly in the pension actuarial business, which they say that pension actuaries are people who wanted to become morticians, but lack the personality. And, you know, I that's not fair to say in general, but it was not something a 28-year-old at that time really wanted to do. So I started thinking about it. I was a partner by that time in the firm we had started, Economic Growth Group. And so I talked to some folks over in Plainfield, and I decided I was going to go into broadcasting. So as one of my engineering friends said, geez, I think I'm going to become an astronaut. And I, you know, it was one of those things that I just thought I had I wanted to do it. And I took some training up in Connecticut for a number of months, and then knocked on a door in West Orange, New Jersey, City of License, Newark, on a small UHF channel. And that was the beginning of my broadcasting career. So again, the Daycroft factor popped up in knowing that I could go to a power and an intelligence much higher than my own, and if I listened, I would be led to do any number of things. You know, it wouldn't necessarily be an easy trip, but it worked out extraordinarily well for me career-wise. And when the monitor channel went down in 92, I was able to transition back to Wall Street with a lot more under my belt. And a lot of different things going on, including three children to support and a wife and so forth. So, you know, the idea of the Daycroft factor stayed with me to encourage me to go into journalism. It definitely affected the way I approached stories, the way I presented stories. I tried to make it interesting, clean, and humorous when I could. And I think that helped. That probably did help because I had a good run. I had, you know, 14 years in front of the camera.
And, oh, yes.
You know, it allowed me to parlay that into a fairly successful return to Wall Street.
It's an amazing career that Bill has had. And I tell you, the time has gone by so quickly here. The book is an excellent read, The Daycroft Factor. And I want to ask you, could we apply those techniques, those values today? Is there a modern application to that? I mentioned in the beginning, do we need to look to the past to understand some of the problems we're dealing with now? Do you see the Daycroft factor as, yes, these values apply today just like they did when you were going there?
Yes, I would have to say they do. They may be called different things.
Yeah.
Now, I had cause at one point when the monitor channel went down, and this is also told in the book, I had an epiphany, if you will. Dear friend of mine, in fact, he was my broker at Merrill Lynch at that time and was a very devout Roman Catholic. And we had some conversations about the situation I faced, which was, do I go out to WBBM in Chicago on a 13-week contract, you know, with a television station out there? That didn't sound like a good idea, particularly since I had already been doing it for 14 years and wanted to stop living on an airplane, start, you know, being with my family a lot more and so forth and so on. And he was just a very common sense guy, a guy named John Abbracimento. And he was also, as they say, very devout. And I came away with that first conversation we had with something that stuck with me for quite some time, which was, you know, I probably have the right religion, but the wrong church. So when my dear late father-in-law passed in 2008, my wife sponsored me to become a member of yet another church. and that concept of, you know, right religion, wrong church also motivated me. I will say this. I think what I call the Daycroft factor, and you could, you know, rename it anything you want, but what I got, the morals and the ethics there, and the work of this really deep thinker of the 19th century, that work is what the church, broadly speaking, needs to marry its past to its future. So to answer your question, I think there's every reason to believe that the closer we try to adhere to the Dacroft factor, the more likely it is that we will resolve problems in our world. One thing that I would point to, Rick, which is always dangerous, when you write something long form that is, that has the risk of becoming perishable, I did do some research on a topic of current interest to many people, and that is the history of the caliphates. And in the research that I did, I learned that that Iran, which is obviously first up in the queue for international news these
yes.
days, was in 1979 declared an Islamic republic, not run by a caliph. A caliphate is sort of a pan-Islamic governance. And what I realized is the biggest problem that those folks have is they can't decide who's in charge. So when you get something like we've seen since 1979, and I covered that story on financial news, mostly as an oil story at the time. But in fact, it was a deeply moral and ethical problem, a divide, as it were, between East and West. And as I dug deeper, and in the fullness of time, I've seen the Dacroft factor could really bring something to that picture. You know, maybe now one of the things about Christian Science, the heart and soul of it is love, capital L, which those folks see as synonymous with God. You know, tough love works sometimes, and sometimes it's necessary. We're going through a thing right now, which the Dacroft factor could really alleviate, no matter which way it were to go. If we lead with, hey, we don't want to, you know, destroy a whole civilization.
Yes.
We want to take a defective ideology that says it's okay to injure. In fact, go ahead and kill somebody if they don't agree with you and convert to your religion. That's defective. In my thinking, that's defective. I don't speak for the Christian Science Church by any means, or the Catholic Church for that matter. But I think it's not a good idea to harbor that in your religious writings. After 9/11, Rick, I bought a copy of the Quran with English translations, for example. And I was astounded because I want to see what the fuss was all about, particularly since my son had graduated college and went straight into the Marine Corps. I don't know what timing is everything. But it occurred to me that this is something most people don't know. I didn't know. And I was fairly well educated and up on this stuff. I didn't really know what the ideological problem was. And what I didn't know was that nobody wants to talk. Up until the last few years, nobody really wants to talk about it much. And they're willing to believe just about anything. So primary documents for me rule. When you read the Quran, there are some beautiful parts in it. You can see this is an Abrahamic religion. It is a monotheistic religion and so forth. But I think the imams and the mullahs got to get together and say, maybe we could tone some of the rhetoric
yes.
down and reform yes. this business of killing people who don't believe what we believe. So anything's possible. I think that's what the Dacroft factor demonstrates and provides is a way of approaching things that isn't, all about death and destruction, but rather about love and life.
Well, it does that and it lays the groundwork. It's so impressive what you've done in the book, and you talk so much about transformations, which is we could do a whole program on transformations and what people go through, sometimes their own choice, sometimes it's out of necessity they go through a transformation. That foundation was laid 12 years at Daycroft, and you do such a remarkable job, and I wish we had more time, and hopefully we can continue this conversation. Four or five topics there we could spend each one a whole program on getting into. The book is available wherever books are sold. It's The Daycroft Factor. Go to our website, thisweekinamerica.us, and you'll have a link there to Amazon, and more importantly, a link to William's website, which is wbdredgeco.com. You can listen to our program on 28 different platforms, podcast platforms, including Apple, Spotify, iHeart, and more, available on YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, and beyond. And don't forget to like, comment, and possibly even subscribe.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.